Welcome to the Mamori Show. This show will inspire you to be true to yourself in the most challenging situations and take action on things you wanted to do for a long time but never felt worthy or good enough or had the courage to do. Get ready to hear moving stories about people like you and me who made a conscious choice to step up to their problems and fears and respond to life's challenges with courage and grace.
Hey, this is me, and I'm the executive producer and host of the Mamori Show. And my guest today is Charles Eisenstein. Hi, Charles.
Hello, Marie.
Hi. And Charles is a speaker and the author of The Essence of Humanity, and the upcoming Sacred Economics, as well as other essays online and in print. And he's also on the faculty of the Health, Arts, and Science program of O'Connor College. Charles lives in Pennsylvania with his three sons, and his work covers topics of money, civilizations, consciousness, transitions, and health. And today, Charles will share with us story about his transition to living his passion in his work. So Charles will talk about stages of rebellion, of wandering, of experiencing the worst and learning to no longer fear it, or learning to trust life, of finding a way on an invisible path. So Charles, I know you as a speaker. When I met you, you already were a speaker and author, and you had a following, and, you know, I saw you interacting with people in amazing ways, and I really, really loved your gift economy idea and your, you know, teaching. And I know that before you became who you are today, you had a pretty bumpy path, and you told me that your first awakening was when you were a teenager, maybe even before.
Yeah. I guess I could, you know, take it back as far as I want to.
Okay.
But when I was listening to the intro to the show, I was thinking that, like, I'm not really sure if I consciously stepped up to, you know, take life by the horns. Really what it was for me was that living in the way I had been living just became so intolerable that I almost had no choice but to live in a different way. And I think that birth is kind of like that. You know, we imagine, and when people are successful, they like to credit themselves with it. But maybe it's like birth, in which the fetus, the baby, only does maybe 1% of the work. And life circumstances, when we've grown enough in our old selves, in our old world, life circumstances, you know, birth us into the new thing. But I just wanted to preface it with that, and then I can explain or I can tell about how it happened to me.
Okay.
So, you know, there I was as a teenager, and I had a very strong sense that there was something wrong with the world, and especially something wrong with the life that had been offered to me, or the world as it had been offered to me as normal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had this voice inside, this feeling that said, this can't be normal, this can't be right, I can't put up with this, this is wrong, it's supposed to be better, it's supposed to be more beautiful, it's supposed to be more exciting.
What exactly were those things that felt wrong to you?
Well,
you know,
on the one hand,
teenagers, I'm just explaining my question. You know, teenagers usually is the age where they think that many things are wrong. Everything's wrong with their
life.
So, but I feel that in your case, it was different. It was deeper. It was on a much deeper level.
Actually, I think that most teenagers are tapping into something very true when they think that everything's wrong. Like school, for example. I mean, that's a dominant fact in most teenagers' lives. And, you know, is it right that you sit in a classroom for 50 minutes learning what you're told is important, and then you have 4 minutes to get to the next class, and then 4 minutes to get to the one after that, and each one is disconnected from the other ones, and you don't get to follow whatever passions you have, and you have 30 minutes to eat lunch, and you're not allowed outdoors. And the things that you learn, I mean, you know, there's we could go on and on about that. So I think that even the average teenager is more tuned in to the wrongness than most adults are, you know, because eventually it's almost like we get broken to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one thing, just like the normal everyday feeling like this can't be right, the petty humiliations of school.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that played into it was that my father had given me all these books in my early teenage years that made it crystal clear that something was wrong with the world. He gave me Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, mm-hmm. which was written in 1962. And it was like the first wake-up call about the state of the environment and how we were polluting it. He gave me Gulag Archipelago,
mm-hmm.
about the prison camps in Russia. He gave me A People's History of the United States, which it's basically a far left account of United States history that turns everything on its head, you know. Oh, George Washington wasn't a good guy after all, and so all of these influences made it impossible for me to fully participate in the life that had been offered to me. And like a lot of people, and this is really common in my generation, in the previous generation, the baby boom generation, you could still get excited about the way things were going. You know, science had achieved all these great triumphs, and we were going to move onward and upward to the stars and conquer disease and all this kind of stuff. And you could still believe in that growing up in the 50s and 60s. You know, we're going to conquer poverty, conquer racism. But by the time I came of age, you could no longer believe that humanity was on the right track and the world was getting better and better. There was just, the wrongness was just too obvious. And so like many people in my generation, I was unable to wholeheartedly participate. And different ones of us resisted the program in different ways. You know, for some people it's depression, they withdraw from life. Other people it's addiction. Other people just kind of get lazy and they become slackers and procrastinate or just make a half-hearted effort.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more of me, you know. I'd made kind of a half-hearted effort to go along with things, but my heart wasn't in it. And so, you know, I went to Taiwan after college.
Mm-hmm.
And just first I worked in a bar, you know, and then eventually I started doing translation, but I never really tried to be a big success because I was not that interested in being a big success. I couldn't really believe in it. I remember one time, here's another key moment. Or am I talking too much? should I keep going?
It's your interview, Charles. You can talk
okay.
For an hour.
All right. Well,
okay.
So here's another key moment. I was about 27, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a meeting, and by this time I was doing business translation and any translation actually, and helping companies localize their products into the, you know, English speaking markets and stuff. And there I was in a meeting, and some people were discussing some new software feature that was upcoming and how it would affect their product and how it would affect their competitors, and it was something like 3D sound or something like that. Can't remember what it was exactly. But everybody in the room was so excited about it, you know? And I thought,
mm-hmm.
I thought, hold on. You mean you guys are actually excited about this? You actually care about this trivial feature, which isn't really going to change anything in the world? because I only care about it because I'm paid to care about it. I don't care about it for real. So I felt like this moment of superiority, you know, this kind of cynical superior feeling. But then the next feeling was a kind of panic, because I thought, my goodness, I don't care about this. I don't care about anything except what I'm paid to care about. When in this lifetime do I get to do something that I care about for real?
Wow.
In other words, when do I get to live my life and not the life I'm paid to live? Like, what about my life? Do I get to have that? And that thought was so alarming to me that once I had it, even more, I was just going through the motions in my work, and I just didn't care. And I knew I didn't care. And it wasn't long after that that I left that work, moved away from the country, from Taiwan, where I had been living, and that environment which reinforced all of my habits and routines, and I just moved with my young family to America with no job, you know, here, but I just had to get away from it because I just couldn't take it. It was excruciating.
Wow, you know, this question that you asked, when will I get to do something that I really care about rather than something I'm paid for? And actually now you're doing something you care about and you are paid for it. And that's my point. You can do things you care about and get paid for them, right?
Yes. It's not, and sometimes it's a long journey to find that, though, because most of the roles that are offered for pay are things that no sane human being would really care about very much.
So you have to create something on your own. You have to create a job for yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what you're doing today, I don't think it was available anywhere on the market. You just created it, and you're doing it right now.
Well, I mean, I knew, you know, when I started writing books, I knew that there's such a thing as an author and that some authors make a living at it. Very, very few, actually, but that it's possible. And so for a while, I was trying to make a living as an author and doing the things that I thought one had to do to make that work, and it didn't work. When I was doing it, even if there was 10% of me that was saying, I'm doing this to make a living, it wasn't working. It was only when I gave up on that and decided I'm just going to do what I want to do. Only then did I start to make a living at it.
So you, if I understand correctly, you live your life with this attitude of, you do nothing to make a living out of it. So there is no you don't have this goal of surviving, of
right,
making money. So you have food tomorrow. You just do what you want to do, and you're provided.
Yeah, I don't do anything. Yeah, I don't do anything because of the money. I only do things because I want to do them. And I'm not saying that it's wrong to do things because of the money. I mean, if that's your perception, then, I mean, I did come to a point where actually a couple years ago where I thought, you know, we're going to be hungry. Me and my children, we're going to be hungry if this keeps up.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to ask myself, at what point will I just do something for the money? And the realization I had was that I will do that if and when my children are actually hungry, and I'm not just projecting that, you know, if things keep going the way they are, they will be hungry. So even when I was totally broke, I had this 50-pound bag of rice, you know, in my house, and some food from my brother who's a farmer. Like, we never went hungry, not even once, even though it looked pretty grim. We never actually went hungry. And so I never actually had to do something that I didn't want to do. But I don't think there's anything, I mean, this isn't about being pure and being good and being virtuous and not soiling my hands with things that I just do for money. But right now, it's true that I don't do anything just for the money.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do, or I don't, yeah.
how did you, you're talking about being broke, and, you know, how did you get there? You, here you got to United States from Taiwan with your family, and then what? How did you get from that point to being broke?
Well, that was a bunch of years.
Writing books?
Yeah, I mean, there were many years in between. Many years in between. I was, for a while, when I was still married, my wife was a real estate agent, and I didn't know what I wanted to do in life. And there were some, you know, relationship dynamics involved here too that I won't go into, but basically I didn't know what I wanted to do, and she did. So I stayed home with the kids and started writing books, but mostly I was just home with the kids. And that, you know, went on for a while, until at one point the marriage fell apart and she stopped doing real estate, and I was, you know, even more busy writing books, and it just, but I wasn't making enough money at all, and things got worse and worse. I went bankrupt, you know. And I mean, I tried many things. I tried teaching yoga. I tried a lot of things before I found what I really want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah.
And I know that after divorce, the kids stayed with you. So all that, you know, situation was with kids. You had three kids when you got broke, right?
Yeah, that's right. I was pretty much a single dad with three kids.
Wow.
But what I was really afraid of, I mean, when it comes right down to it, my fear wasn't really of starving or of physical deprivation. My fear was more of the humiliation of having to ask people for help and to receive help even, and to and it's tied into a fear of fully receiving, because
that isn't,
receiving gifts, I mean. And a lot of people are hesitant to receive gifts, because when you receive a gift, then you are in a state of obligation toward either that person or toward the community or toward the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to, people today, they want to stay free of obligation, independent.
Why?
To me, that's anti-life, you know, to remain free of obligations.
Why is that? Why do you think, can you expand on this a little bit? Why is it obligation, and why people resist it? Because receiving gifts seems like such a nice thing. You know, I think when you say receiving gifts, I think I imagine a birthday party. And here everybody is coming, bringing a gift. You know, why would you have resistance to that?
Yes.
If you have birthday party every day of your life, why would anyone have resistance to that?
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? Hold on a second. I have to. Just a minute. I'll be back in 5 seconds. Okay, I have a sick kid at home, and I was making some chicken soup for him, and I had to turn it off.
Okay.
But I'm back now. See, life intrudes on these interviews, doesn't it? But yes, so the fear of receiving. Well, the way that gifts work, and a lot of the thinking I do is about the gift, is that gifts come from a feeling of gratitude. When we feel gratitude, we desire to give, and gratitude is the feeling of, is the knowledge of having received a gift and the desire to give in turn. So when we receive gifts, even if the person has no intention of getting something back, at least I feel like I want to give back. It's a kind of an obligation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, today we have this ideal of financial independence, which really means I don't need anybody because I can pay for it. I don't need anybody's gifts. I don't need anybody's goodwill. I'm independent. And this, we elevate this as some kind of paradise to be attained. But when people actually achieve it, they find that it's no paradise at all because they have no community then. They don't need anybody, but and no one really needs them either. And if somebody disappears, if I'm financially independent and the farmer who grows my food or the cashier in the supermarket who rings it up or my doctor or my anything, if they died, then that's okay. I can pay someone else to do it. I don't need them.
Mm-hmm.
And by the same token, in a specialized money-based society, no one needs us either, so we're replaceable too. And that's why community is so hard to create today if you have money, because anytime you gather together, there's an unspoken realization of, I don't need you. How can you really have community if that's the underlying knowledge?
So but, you think that community, I mean, I'm hearing you. You think that we have difficulty in creating communities because of money?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because community is woven from gifts. Because gifts create obligation, they create gratitude.
Do you see a possibility for creating community in which people do have money and they share gifts and they open with it?
Yeah. Although, if you have plenty of money and you give somebody gifts that could be bought with money, then you're not really giving them something that they need uniquely from you because they could just go buy it. Now, you could create community with the things that money cannot buy. Although today, more and more things are purchased with money that were once part of a gift economy. For example, wise advice and a shoulder to cry on. People never used to pay for that, but now they go to their therapist or their life coach or something like that, and they pay for what was once free.
Mm-hmm.
Another example would be child care, which even when I was a kid, that's something people rarely paid for. It was very normal for neighbors to watch each other's kids after school. But now it's like, oh, you want me to watch your kids so that you don't have to pay a daycare center? You know, and you kind of feel like if you ask your neighbors to watch your kids, you kind of feel like, oh, maybe I should pay them something, you know. But what the payment does is it erases the tie or the connection that would be formed if it had been a gift. If I give my neighbor the gift of childcare, then there's kind of an expectation, or you could say it's an expectation that he will someday give me something, or it could just be a feeling that persists in him that he wants to do something because he's received. In a real community, the person you give to might not be the same person who gives back to you. You might give to somebody.
That's an amazing idea. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you can still, anyway, to just get back to your question, you know, you can still create gatherings, and if there's something left that cannot be bought for money, then you can still create community out of it. But I've just been to so many things where we're like, okay, we're going to create a community, you know, and then people just don't come to the next one. So let's set up a listserv. Let's email each other, you know, and community just doesn't happen, and it's because people don't need each other as individual, specific people.
You know, I really, really love this idea that you just expressed about unity of the universe. I think it's impossible to really be that, leave that from your heart, leave that way, that the person you give to not necessarily will be the person you receive from.
Uh-huh.
I think that approach is only possible if you see, if you experience everything from very, you know, from oneness, from that place
yeah.
of, you know, that the universe is a united kind of being and you're a part of it. And so you can give someone, or someone can give to you and you can give to someone else. And that it doesn't matter energetically, it's the same thing, even when you give to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's still the same connection. It's really beautiful. So all these wonderful ideas about receiving, and I understand that today you know how to receive, you've learned how to receive, and you teach people how to receive. But I want to take you back to that point in your life where you didn't know how to receive. And when you said that the scariest part for you was when you were broke and you had kids with you, the scariest part for you was to ask people for help. Was that the moment in your life where you actually had that shift of into who you are today, that shift of being able to ask for help? And if you have some examples of actually asking for help and realizing that this is a wonderful thing, because
yeah.
I'm sure there are many people listening now who have problem to ask for help. I had a big problem asking for help myself for years and years. You know, so if you can reflect
yeah.
on how the shift happened for you.
Yeah. I don't think there was one defining moment, but there were some pretty important realizations. One of the realizations was that when I, in the past, had asked for help, I kind of did it from this very subtle victim mentality that said, I need help, and you really should give me help because I've suffered so much and I really deserve it. So you're kind of obligated to give me help. And I wasn't actually giving people a chance to be generous. It's like if you say, like, okay, I needed a place to stay. I was asked to leave a place I had been staying, and I had almost no money to pay for anything. And I ended up, the way it happened was really easy. It was so easy. I just mentioned to my chiropractor that I needed a place to stay. And he said, oh, I know these people. They have a place called River Sanctuary, and they're looking for a new housemate or something. And so I ended up living with them they didn't really charge rent. They just asked me to share expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in the past, I would have felt uncomfortable with receiving what was really a gift, right? That, by letting me live there with no rent, that's a gift. And in the past, I would have tried to deactivate the gift by essentially saying either to them or just to myself, well, you know, I've had such bad luck and I've been so good. I've been trying so hard and nothing's worked out and poor me. And therefore, I don't need to feel gratitude for this gift because I deserved it. I was entitled to it.
You deserved it because of your suffering.
Right. And that was what in the past I would have done to give myself permission to receive and to excuse myself from feeling gratitude. Right? If you think, oh, I just deserve that anyway, then there's no reason for gratitude and no call to give in return.
Mm-hmm.
And that attitude, that attitude is actually what blocks the incoming flow of gifts. It's called begging, actually.
Hmm.
Where you know, on some level, you're trying to hook the other person's pity.
And it usually triggers sacrificial attitude in these people. Usually they
mm-hmm.
do it from the place of sacrificing something.
Right. Yep.
It makes them feel good about themselves because of sacrificing. But that's where I think that's what it triggers in them.
Yeah, right. And there's a whole psychological dynamic that goes along with that. But just for me on the personal level, it was very freeing to say, to allow people to be generous. And it was scary because it called on me to do that too, to be generous too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a very different way of living. And like, I'm no master at it. I'm still getting used to it, in fact, and I still discover subtle ways in which I'm begging. And when I discover them, I feel uncomfortable about them. I usually, well, it's actually the discomfort that cues me in to them. And then, you know, I go through a process where I choose to no longer do that.
So you allowed people to be generous towards you and you felt gratitude. What did you do? Was it a new feeling for you, that feeling of free, kind of free gratitude? I mean, not obligation, but not out of obligation, but just out of pure gratitude?
Let me see if I can give you a concrete example.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, like I lead retreats and seminars and things.
Mm-hmm.
And I run them on a gift basis so that people will just pay, you know, the hard costs, room and board, and usually I include my travel expenses in there so that at least I'm breaking even. You know, I'm not subsidizing the other people's experience, but I'm not charging them for it either. And then on top of that, if they feel gratitude, I tell them, you know, that your fee is paid the hard costs, and if you feel gratitude for what I've given, then you can give me a gift in return. And that's very clear. There's no begging in that. But sometimes I notice that I'll try to insinuate into it a little hint of how I've sacrificed and how I've suffered and therefore how they should give me more. And then I'm not trusting on their gratitude. I'm actually appealing to their guilt. And it doesn't feel good. When I notice ways in which I'm doing that, it doesn't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, it is counterproductive. It actually limits the flow of gifts. So I'm learning not to do that. And I want to say also that there's a kind of a mystery around the gift, that when you give a gift, you don't know how the return gift will come. It may come from the person you gave it to. It may come from the community that witnessed the gift that you gave that person, either because it was public or because they told somebody about it. But it might come in mysterious ways just from the universe, and there's no logical connection, but you just somehow feel that you're being thanked. So it's something I'm just learning about right now. I'm not an expert in this. There are many people who have lived in the gift much more deeply than I have for decades and decades.
You know, when you're talking about gratitude and giving gifts back, and is there a difference between the feeling of gratitude that you're talking about and feeling of, I just think about myself in the past, you know, when somebody would give me something, I immediately felt that I had to give something to them. And that was not necessarily a feeling of gratitude, that was feeling of breaking even, kind of.
Yeah, that's right. That's actually a way of cutting off gratitude. If you give a return gift too quickly, then it's almost like an exchange, and it's saying, we're even now.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when someone gives me the gift of a compliment, I notice myself doing that. Instead of really accepting it, because sometimes it's a big compliment, you know. Someone might tell me something really moving and personal and for example, that my words have changed their life or something like that. And I've discovered that I have these subtle ways of refusing that gift. One is to say thank you too quickly, without really meaning it. Another is to say, you know, you would have received that message one way or another. I was just the instrument, kind of false humility. And so for me to really take it in, sometimes it's big. I mean, sometimes it's hard to take in something that big. So I do notice myself doing what you just said, like this wanting to give a return gift so quickly that there's no feeling of having received. There's only a feeling of having made an exchange and now we're even and now I don't have to have anything to do with you anymore. I don't have to have a connection. But a real gift leaves a connection. And then the return gift deepens the connection when the return gift happens. But I think it's really important to allow the receiving to sink in fully. Otherwise, it just becomes this formalized ritual of and you're just breaking even and you're not creating a tie.
I think it comes down to realizing when you receive fully, here's what I've learned from my own experience, you have to realize how much you matter. You just have to. I think that's why I'm talking from my personal experience. For me, that was the most difficult part, you know. I remember I had this healing session with one of my clients, and she's a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And a week before that session, she asked me for advice about a kid they had problem with, and they had parent meeting with school principal and all that. And I just, you know, connected to energy, and I gave her advice on how to work with the kid and talk to parents. And she came next session, and she started thanking me. That was one of the most difficult times in my life, believe me or not.
Uh-huh.
Because she kept going, you know. She said, oh, my gosh, thank you so much. You really helped. And I said, okay. And then she said, you know, you really changed this kid's life. You know, you don't understand what you did for this kid. And she kept going, and I was counting. I was sitting down and counting how many times she expressed this thank you, and she kept going. You know, she couldn't stop, and she had tears. And eventually I had to scream. I had, stop, I cannot take it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she could not understand what was going on, but I just said, you know, it's been fifth time that you're telling me in different words how thankful you are, and I just cannot take it, because I felt that the deeper I was taking it in, the deeper I had to realize how much I matter. And if you don't really, you know, if you don't really know how much you matter and you don't allow yourself to feel that feeling,
mm-hmm.
it is very difficult to take these gifts in and let them just, you know, be inside of you, kind of like feel you with their presence and
mm-hmm.
connect to a deep place in you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Another way to look at that is, you know, you say that you matter. One way I look at that is that I'm a unique and important part of the universe that's essential to the harmonious functioning of the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I have, like everybody, I have unique gifts to offer. And accordingly, the universe has unique gifts for me, too. And to fully accept that I am important, that I do matter, that I am unique, that is, it's hard for me too, to step into that realization, because I think it's part of this resistance to life, that in our culture it's very strong that we want to kind of be aloof and to be separate and for things not to matter too much and to be independent and to be detached, to not have attachments. And eventually, and that attitude even infects our spirituality, where we're supposed to be kind of separate from the world, in it and not of it, et cetera, and practice non-attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And I got sick of that. You know, I said, in this human life, I want to be fully alive. I want to be attached. I want to experience the flesh. I want to love, and when I lose, I want it to hurt. I'm sick of staying partially alive.
Hmm.
To me, that is very tied in with fully giving and fully receiving.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, you know. I agree that many people think that spirituality is about departing into fifth dimension or seventh dimension or whatever.
Yes.
Everybody has a different number.
Yeah, like what about the third dimension? I like the third dimension.
Me too. I'm so three-dimensional. Just love my swing and, you know, and
yeah.
Nature and, oh my gosh, it's so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah, and I figure I'll have a chance to experience other dimensions later. But I want to make the most of this one, and it's so rich. There's just so much here.
Right. So when you talk about this feeling of, you know, fully receiving, being able to fully receive, I know you're an expert on this, so I would love to hear more from you about it. Because I still feel, you know, I cannot tell you how many clients I had who had problem with receiving. People feel more comfortable actually to give because
yes.
I think that puts them into a position of being in control.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that receiving makes you feel kind of vulnerable, very vulnerable.
Right. Yeah, because then you owe somebody something. Either you owe somebody or you owe the community or you owe the universe something.
That's what you think it is about? That's why you feel vulnerable?
I think so. Yeah, and also you feel like you're dependent. It's like being on charity or something. You're dependent then, and we consider it a virtue to be independent, to be able to pay for anything and not have to depend on somebody's gifts. But that's an illusion. We are dependent on other beings completely. We're dependent on the sun. We're dependent on the earth. We're dependent on the trees. We're dependent on society. I mean, we're totally dependent. And the only thing that the illusion of money, of financial independence does is it makes us dependent on people we don't know instead of dependent on people we do know.
How about in terms of the universe? You know, you just mentioned the sun and the trees and all that. How about being dependent on the moment, you know, being dependent on tomorrow, being dependent on, I found that the most difficult probably for the human mind is to feel dependent on the unknown. Because
mm-hmm.
that's, at least that's how my life looks. You know,
yeah.
I walk in trust that every day will bring something that I need, and in terms of money, in terms of relationships, in terms of everything. So
yeah.
It's kind of you depend on the unknown.
Yeah, and sometimes this trust that I will receive what I need, it includes the understanding that I might not know what I need, and that what I receive might not look like what I think I need.
Exactly.
Because, like, in my life, you know, going bankrupt was just what I needed. But I would never have asked for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, most of the calamities that have happened in my life were just what I needed. So that's like, the universe is so generous that it gives us even more than we know to ask for.
Even more. But when you look back on that situation of being broke and, you know, do you see it as a gift from the universe, actually?
Yeah, totally. That was such a rich experience. And it just cleaned out of me all of these, you know, false ambitions, the things that I thought I wanted but didn't really want. There's a beautiful poem in Rumi somewhere. There's a sheikh or something who, it is said, he prays loud and long, blessing the thieves and robbers who beat him up and leave him for dead on the street. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because he says, they remind me that what I want isn't what they want.
Mm.
So so I see like the various thieves and robbers, illness and divorce and bankruptcy and all of these things that happen to me as reminders that what I want isn't what society has conditioned me to want. And I'm grateful that I mean, there was a time where I was kind of, you know, trying to be, you know, a hotshot author and to promote myself, and my heart wasn't in it, but I kind of went through the motions. And I'm really glad that that didn't succeed and that I didn't waste years pursuing a mirage. I'm really glad that now I've been through that and I can just totally focus on the gift that delights me. I love my work and I feel free now. Having experienced what I feared, I feel free now to just do what I do what I want to do, and not to have to worry so much about getting. I like getting.
No.
I like receiving, but it's just not my department to engineer that very much.
You know, Charles, many people are afraid of doing what they love. And one of the biggest reasons is their feeling of responsibility to their family, especially when they have kids. I find that in many cases, kids kind of hold us back from truly experiencing life and taking risks, and because we feel responsible for providing to our kids the best we can. And your example just shows that it is possible to take risks even with kids, and I'm sure your kids benefited from this transformation you went through also very much.
Yes. I mean, I think most people know that ultimately what is best for themselves will also end up being best for their children, and that their desire for their children's well-being is automatically incorporated into their decisions. But I want to also, I don't want this gift orientation or living in the gift or not doing things for the purpose of money, I don't want this to become like some heroic goal that you have to achieve it, you have to do it right now in order to be happy or in order to be virtuous or admirable, you know. I think that we are given opportunities that are just at the edge of our courage to take a step toward where we want to go. And that when the time comes that a transition is necessary that's beyond our courage to consciously choose, then the universe in its ultimate generosity will make us do what we didn't have the courage to choose to do. So if it's, say, a job that's no longer serving you, then and you just, but it's like, oh, but I need the insurance, you know, I need the benefits and my children and this and this and this, and I just can't, I just can't quit it, you know, even though it's killing my soul, I cannot quit this job. I'm afraid to, I'm too afraid. Oh, but I'm torturing myself because I should quit it, you know, because I'm not living my life purpose, but I'm afraid to, but I've got to make myself do it, and this can turn into this self-torture. And in that situation, I would suggest to realize when I'm ready, I will have the courage to quit this job. And either that or something will happen that I no longer will be able to do this job. You know, you get fired, you get sick, something happens, it just doesn't work. Like that's what happened to me. You know, nothing worked. When I was trying to be a success and promote myself, everything went wrong. I was not allowed to continue doing that, basically. But I just, you know, I don't want people to feel panicked or to feel that what I've done is something that's unattainable for them. It was, you know, I had a lot of help doing it. I was forced into doing it. It was because it's not that I'm more noble or more courageous than anybody out there. It's truly that I was born and I did 1% of the work myself, and the other 99% was my unconscious or the universe conspiring to birth me into this state. And that's the way it happens. You're in a world and you grow within that world, and the fears you have fears that protect you and keep you in that world. And then eventually when you grow up against its limits, the fears that were once protective become confining, and then you're born. You get propelled into a new world. It's very natural and no cause for self-torture.
This is such a great advice. Thank you so much, Charles, for this wonderful interview. And as we wrap this up for today, and if somebody is listening to this and they want to learn more about your work, could you give them your website and how to find you?
Yeah. My main website is ascentofhumanity.com. You can also Google me, Charles Eisenstein. I've got tons of essays online that you can find, a lot of them on Reality Sandwich, a website, realitysandwich.com. The book, The Ascent of Humanity, is you can get it on Amazon. You can also read it online. There's tons of, videos and all kinds of stuff that you can just Google around. And you can also contact me through my website. There's a contact form there somewhere.
Well, thank you, Charles. Thank you so much. And for our listeners, if you have a comment or a question for Charles, you can also read it on his guest page on the Mamrie website, and Charles will be able to answer your question there. And if you feel grateful for what you received from this show and move to give back by supporting the show financially, or you'd like to maybe even become a sponsor for the show, you can contact us through visiting Give Back page on Mamrie's website. And when you're visiting the show website, don't forget to sign up for our free newsletter. It has tons of great information. And if you feel that you're ready to step up to your fears and problems and experience your life to the fullest, but you don't know how to begin or how to break through, I am available for phone or Skype consultations. So if you want to learn about my healing work and how to contact me for one-on-one private consultation, you can visit Marie's healing work page on the Mamrie Show website. You've been listening to the Mamrie Show with Marie. And next week, my guests are Brenda Michaels and Robert Spears. And Brenda and Michael actually have an amazing story about they're both cancer survivors, and they refused to undergo through regular chemotherapy, and they decided to treat their illness with natural treatment. And today they have a wonderful radio show. So I really look up to interviewing them. You've been listening to The Mamrie Show. And until next week, remember, no matter how big your challenge is, you're always greater than your challenge. No matter how big your dream is, you're always greater than your dream. See you at the next show.